What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the years since the American sugar industry's first full-throated defense of sugar in our diet, American obesity has tripled. Diabetes is up 900%. And that's just the beginning, says my guest today. This hour on Point, the case against sugar. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you cut back? Tried cutting back? How did that go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Our diets are saturated in sugar, so has our media been. And for a long time, 50 years of the Lucky Charms jingle here was for the 50th anniversary. In 2014, the a cappella group The Pentatonix recorded a new version for Lucky Charms.
Stars and horseshoes, clovers and blue moons,
hourglasses, rainbows,
tasty red balloons. Frosted Lucky Charms, they're magically delicious.
Yummy sugar, and that's 50 years old. New turn on a 50-year-old jingle. Here, 2016, Coca-Cola announced a new global marketing campaign, Taste the Feeling. Here's a clip from its campaign anthem featuring Conrad Sewell.
No one can't stop me when I taste the feeling. Nothing could ever bring me down. Taste the feeling.
Boy, sugar is just great. Or maybe it's not. Here's Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatrics, University of California, San Francisco. Some pretty harsh criticism of sugar in the documentary Fed Up.
Sugar is poison. It is a chronic, not acute, chronic, dose-dependent, depends on how much you eat, because there is a safe threshold, hepato, liver, toxin.
It is poison. My guest today, Gary Taubes, is pretty tough himself. Science writer, author of the new book, The Case Against Sugar. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He's with me in the studio. Gary Taubes, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Is the doctor right? Is sugar poison?
Rob Lustig is a bit tad hyperbolic when he talks about it, although basically I agree with him. Yeah, I think sugar's a long-term toxin, most likely, that does its damage over years and decades.
I want to talk about the history of our sugar's integration into our diet, the growth in our diet, our understanding of sugar. But take us, if you would, right to your sort of list of horribles about sugar right off the bat. Like, what's your bottom line on sugar?
Okay, so here's the thing. For the century, the worst that was ever said about sugar is that it's empty calories.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I heard that again and again as a
yeah,
kid.
As sugar has saturated our diets and obesity and diabetes rates have exploded, we end up with this concept that you know, the reason we have diabetes is because of obesity, and the reason people get obese is we eat too much. And so you eat too much sugar, that's going to cause obesity. You eat too much of anything, it's going to cause obesity. That's the worst that we could say. You practice moderation, all's good. That's what the sugar industry has relied on. It's
whatever moderation is in the American diet, where what we think of as moderation could be a whole lot of sugar.
Yeah, we could. The last chapter of my book spends a lot of time addressing this concept of moderation. Here's the other argument. The other argument is that sugar is the prime suspect for a condition called insulin resistance. Insulin resistance, and this is Rob Lustig's argument as well, mm-hmm. Insulin resistance is at the heart of a condition called metabolic syndrome that is, for all intents and purposes, the reason why most people get heart disease in this country. So CDC says 75 million Americans have metabolic syndrome. That includes the obese Americans. It includes Americans with diabetes. If sugar causes insulin resistance, then it causes obesity and diabetes, and we could use the same meaning of the term causality as we use when we say cigarettes cause lung cancer. So nobody says smoking too much causes lung cancer. Nobody says drinking too much alcohol causes fatty liver disease, and yet they, you know, we just say smoking causes lung cancer. Alcohol causes fatty liver disease. I'm arguing in this book that sugar is the most likely cause of diabetes, which today afflicts 30 million Americans.
And you're writing lately that it also elevates the risk of virtually every major chronic disease, from heart disease to cancer and Alzheimer's.
Well, so obesity and diabetes are both associated with an increased risk of cancer and Alzheimer's. They're both cancer and Alzheimer's have insulin-related mechanisms. Remember, I had mentioned that the initial step in this speculative cause and effect is that sugar causes insulin resistance. So if it does and it causes obesity and diabetes, then you can make the argument that it at least increases the risk of cancer and dementia, and arguably is a primary dietary cause.
A whole lot of people like their cookies and cake and their Coke and all the rest. Are you saying slam the brakes on? You're killing yourself in the same way we learned to think about tobacco decades ago now?
Well, yeah, except here's the issue. Again, 90% of smokers will never get lung cancer. So a significant portion of the population can clearly tolerate the sugar in their diets, even assuming I'm right about the arguments. But on the other hand, you know, we know that cigarettes cause lung cancer, and that's the primary reason why we advocate against smoking them. They also increase risk of heart disease, emphysema. So, yeah, I'm suggesting that for those people who really care about being healthy, which often doesn't include anyone under the age of about 21, it's a very good idea to think about cutting back or quitting sugar consumption.
We should clarify on diabetes. Of course, you're talking about type 2 diabetes, not type 1 that people are born with. But
well, people aren't born with type 1, but the type 2 represents 95% of the cases. One of the arguments I make in the book is that, as I said, there's an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. You can trace that back to the 19th century, coincident with the first major increases in sugar consumption. Type 1 diabetes has also increased. It's still a much, much rarer condition, but you look at per capita prevalence, it's increased steadily also since the 19th century, and it's not out of the question that it's related.
I want to go to the science. I want to go to our diets today and the debates over what's the appropriate level of sugar and its implications, all the health implications you're talking about here. But take us back to that history of sugar consumption, because I think that a lot of people think of, you know, pie and cake and sweets all over the place as a deep, long tradition. But you talk about an explosion of sugar consumption. Take us back to that.
Yeah, so until the early 19th century, sugar was so expensive that it was basically a very rare luxury for, you know, the wealthy, and certainly dominated by the head of the family. With the Industrial Revolution, it gets less expensive to refine sugar. Excuse me. And then beet sugar comes in the mid-19th century, thanks to Napoleon, who had to create a beet sugar industry.
So refined first out of sugarcane out of the Caribbean, heavily.
Right, and then out of the tropics. And then when the French and Germans realized how they could get sugar from sugar beets, it became something that could be grown in the northern hemisphere or in the temperate zones as well. Mm-hmm. So now you have twice as much sugar. 1840s sees the invention of the candy industry, the chocolate industry, the ice cream industry. So prior to that point, all of these foods, for the most part, didn't exist. Ice cream goes back to the, you know, a couple hundred years further, but it was such a rarity that if somebody had an
queen.
Ice cream cone, yeah, really, it's written up in the newspapers. 1870s, 1880s, the soft drink industry kicks up. By 1920, across the 19th century, sugar availability in this country, and so I assume consumption, went up by a factor of 10, 15 over that century. By 1920, for the first time ever, the sugar industry is making 100 pounds of sugar per capita, and sugar has been transformed into this luxury, from this luxury that, you know, was a rare treat or a weekly treat to beginning to saturate our diet in every possible way. And children and women have been targeted as the consumers. And so children and women might be particularly susceptible to the effects of sugar. This transformation is continued through the 1930s with the fruit juice industry kicks up. We don't think this way, but in order to have fruit juices and cold sodas in your houses, for instance, we needed refrigerators and freezers in our houses, and those don't start appearing at a level that the common man can afford in the U.S. until the 1930s. And then finally, in the 1950s, the sugary cereals come along, because the cereal industry was founded at the turn of the early years of the 20th century by health reformers. Kellogg and Post both ran sanatoriums for the well-heeled dyspeptic, and they cereal was originally, you know, a food you could eat with a lot of fiber to help digestion and bowel movements. So they had nutritionists who said, you can't put sugar in cereal. Sugar's bad for you. But by the late 1940s, one company did Post with Sugar Crisps. And once they did, it's like a you know, it's an arms race to every one of the major cereal manufacturers said, look, had their marketing people arguing with their nutrition people saying, I don't care what you say anymore. We have to come up with an explanation because we have to compete. We have to make sugar-coated cereals. So by the 60s, you've got basically, breakfast is dessert, and Americans are never going 2 hours without sugar, from sodas, from juices, from candies, from snacks, in the foods.
Were people aware, as the use of sugar and in the diet exploded, that their diet was changing? Were people writing about, oh my God, you know, donuts and cakes and pies everywhere, this is new, or did it just seep in and became understood as a norm?
No, you find it throughout the literature. People saying, I mean, I've got to start the book with a quote from the New York Times in the 1850s saying, look what happened to our diet with sugar and all our diseases are caused by it in the 1910s and 20s. You've got physicians blaming sugar on virtually every chronic disease, you know, you could imagine, and they're doing it because in large part they've recognized how much the diet has changed over their lifetime and how much sugar has become, you know, the norm, even in the 1920s.
And yet it is, you know, very widely just, as you say, part of life. Americans don't go 2 hours without it.
Well, and this is the issue I had to address in the book, because if I'm going to say sugar is toxic, the question is, well, why are you writing this? Why do you have to write this book in 2017? I mean, on one level, we always knew sugar was bad for us. If your mother was health conscious in any way, she probably told you to
lay off a
sugar,
little bit,
to ration sugar. On the other hand, the nutrition community has just embraced a couple of misconceived notions over the century that have left the sugar industry this out that they've always had, that there's nothing worse about sugar than empty calories.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new attack on sugar in our diets as more harmful than we know, a kind of sweet, silent killer. My guest is Gary Taub, science writer, author of the new book, The Case Against Sugar. And it's a very, very tough case indeed. You can read an excerpt from his book at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us here or online. What do you think? Do you hesitate at sugar these days, at sweets, at sugar all over in our food? Do you pause because of weight concerns or because of the sugar itself, what it could do to you? Have you heard the list of horrors now associated with sugar, all the ways it can apparently wreck your body or contribute to that? Does it sound fair to call sugar the new tobacco, or does that just sound over the top? Gary Taub is with me in the studio. You said a couple of things that caught my ear as we talked about the history of how sugar production and therefore consumption just exploded. One was about women and children being the target for the sugar industry, and you said that they are particularly susceptible to the effects of sugar. Women and children, what do you mean by that?
Well, they may be particularly susceptible or particularly vulnerable. So children in particular, for no other reason than if the dose makes the poison, as Dr. Lustig said, so they're getting a large dose. I mean, I once did this insane exercise of calculating if I let my son have 25 grams of sugar in a fruity yogurt when he's 5 and weighs 50 pounds, that's the equivalent of me having at 220 pounds, 4.5 to 120 grams of sugar in one sitting. So we don't think like that. We don't decide what's good or bad based on the size of the infant. Plus, they're going to clearly be exposed for a longer period of time because they're going to be consuming it earlier. So if
it's a pattern in childhood.
Yeah. Then with women, women produce children. And one of the chapters in this book is called the if-then problem one. There are two if-then problems. And the first if-then problem is the what's called the intrauterine transfer of this condition called insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. So when women get pregnant, the reason they get tested for gestational diabetes is because if they are diabetic when they're pregnant or obese when they're pregnant, which means if they have high blood sugar and high insulin levels, they're going to give birth to children who in turn are more likely to become obese and or diabetic when they're in adulthood. And these were studies that were done in a Native American tribe called the Pima in beginning in the 1960s. And the numbers are startling at how powerful this transmission is while the baby is in the womb.
So if the mother is a heavy consumer of sugar while she's pregnant or even before? Or just
well, again, even before. If she's got this condition called insulin resistance, which I'm saying is sugar is the prime suspect for.
How prevalent is that?
I don't know. I actually can't answer that number. It's common enough that it's tested for frequently.
Insulin resistance.
Insulin resistance. And, again, this gestational diabetes during pregnancy. So, again, this is the issue. If one of the possible explanations for those these obesity and diabetes epidemics that we see worldwide is that as sugar saturates a diet and women feel the effects and begin to become obese and diabetic themselves, they give birth to children who are more likely. So each successive generation is going to increase, is going to manifest a greater proportion of obesity and diabetes simply because of what happened in their mother's generation or their grandmother's generation.
Tobacco comes to mind when we think how hard it is to wean people off of sugar. What about its? Is it fair to describe them as addictive qualities or not?
Well, again, we don't really know for sure. One of the arguments I make in the book is the sugar industry waged a very successful public relations campaign in the 1970s to convince the public health community and the physicians that sugar was harmless, and anyone who said otherwise was a quack. And by doing so, they pretty much stifled research on sugar. The NIH didn't fund it. Researchers wouldn't pursue it because it looked bad. So from the 80s, nobody was really studying. There may be three research groups in the world who were studying this question of whether sugar is addictive. My preferred statement on this is my first book, first chapter of my book addresses this issue of whether sugar should be looked at as a food or a drug. My friend, the science journalist historian Charles Mann captured this perfectly in his book, 1493, where he discussed the sugar industry. And he said, scientists debate amongst themselves whether sugar is an addictive substance or people just act like it is. And
I don't really understand that. Anybody who's sort of prone to it knows, has felt that urge. Have some, you want more.
That's exactly
the
issue.
Get it steady in your diet and you don't want it to taper off.
Exactly. So that's the issue. And if you have children. If you're a parent, you don't need a peer-reviewed academic literature to tell you that sugar is at least a problem, that it has to be rationed, that it's probably addictive in some profound sense. And there's a lot of us, me included, who wrestle with the phenomena you just described where you have one bite. You can be completely no cravings, no nothing. Yeah. You see something sweet that tastes good.
Just have a nibble.
Just have a nibble, and then this craving fires up, which is probably how many alcoholics perceive alcohol. But it's not, for instance, a different kind of addiction than cigarette smoking, where you have a cigarette, you're fine for however long. Clearly, writing this book, by the way, was informed by two facts of my life that I couldn't avoid. I'm a parent with two pre-adolescent boys, and managing their sugar consumption is something I do, whether I'm a zealot or not.
And in our culture, that's a challenge.
That's a challenge, and I was a smoker. So I know what it's like to be addicted to something that you can't imagine living your life without. So when saying what I'm saying about sugar, I'm clearly playing the Grinch stealing Christmas role. The title I would have preferred for the book would have been Stealing Christmas, the Case Against Sugar. But when you're a smoker, you can't imagine life without cigarettes. It permeates everything you do from the moment you wake up to the moment you get to every single activity, joyful, sad, you punctuate with a cigarette, modulate your emotions with a cigarette, and then you give it up, you feel terrible. For 3 weeks, it's cravings that are almost uncontrollable. For 3 months, you're cranky and angry and depressed, and you lose most of your friends if you don't warn them about
this.
And for a year, you're generally unhappy, and eventually you get to the point where you can't imagine you ever smoked.
Is getting off sugar as tough as that?
I don't think so. And clearly, anecdotally...
It depends on the person.
It depends on the person. But the other problem with smoking is we've managed to regulate it to the point, that mainly because of secondhand smoke, that you can go days or weeks without actually seeing someone smoking.
Yeah.
Whereas, and you clearly don't need a smoke. Sugar is in virtually every packaged and processed food, and it's a common part of our life. I mean, when I came into your offices here today, you've got a bowl of candy bars for your guests sitting in your...
Great.
It's...
I happily blow right by that.
The Uber driver on my way here offered me mints.
He said, have some sugar.
You know, it's just, it's if that had happened, if there was cigarettes were that ubiquitous and that accepted, I never would have quit. And the other thing that happens...
People used to keep cigarettes sometimes on their desk and offer them to every visitor. How about a smoke?
That's true. So, and which is a good sign, which means we got to that point from... You sometimes have to look back far enough to see how things have really changed.
Gary Taub's new book is The Case Against Sugar. And, Gary, there are a lot of listeners calling in for you. Let's go to Rexburg, Idaho, and Sharon. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just had a question about naturally occurring sugar, such as fructose in fruit and that kind of thing. I know there's an argument about... fiber, and a lot of conflicting information out there, and I've always been a fan of fruit, and I just wondered what the information is there on that.
Gary, sugar in fruits, naturally occurring.
So it's the same sugars, but as Dr. Lustig said, it's the dose that makes the poison. That's the so if you're consuming an apple, for instance, you'll get about 7% of the calories are from sucrose or fructose, as opposed to Coca-Cola, where 100% of the calories are from sucrose. Half of those are fructose. So in a fruit, you're going to get a much smaller dose. To get the same dose, if you're not turning it into a fruit juice or a smoothie, it might take you an hour to consume enough apples to get the equivalent sugar of a can of Coke or a can of apple juice. On the other hand... One of the things we do in this country is we give public health advice for the entire nation as though obese people and people with diabetes are going to thrive on the same diets that lean marathon runners will thrive on. And to me, that's almost inconceivable. And I think, you could think of it if you have diabetes and you eat an apple, you have to cover it with insulin. You have to take an insulin shot to prepare for that apple, which tells you that maybe the healthy thing to do, certainly if you're diabetes, is not to eat the apple.
So
you can make this argument that for some proportion of the population, they should be avoiding the sugar and carbohydrates and fruits, regardless of the vitamins and minerals and fiber with which they're packed.
And that portion would be what portion? Who are we talking about? What's the profile of who should avoid it?
Well, again, the estimate today is that from the CDC and 30 million Americans
Who are they? Which one should be avoiding?
The obese and those with diabetes, and I would argue those of us who are predisposed, and we know who we are.
To predispose to obesity and diabetes?
Well, certainly to obesity.
If you gain weight easily.
Yeah, if you gain weight easily. You don't need a doctor or physician to tell you that you're a person who tends to accumulate fat and your brother or your sister isn't.
Mm. Chandler in Omaha, Nebraska. Chandler, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a question for the gentleman on today. I always learned, way back in school that too much of anything was bad, and it was kind of a common sense thing, to not have too much fat or sugar or salt even. But my question is the author really against all sugar or just maybe too much of it?
Well, the question becomes, how do you define too much? I was in giving a talk in Seattle on Friday, and the elevator of the hotel I was staying at had a quote from Mark Twain that would have agreed with what you were taught. It said, too much of anything is bad. Too much good whiskey is just getting started. This is the issue. You can't define. Too much is a tautology. If something's too much, it is by definition bad. As soon as we say excess, something, it is by definition bad. We're making a tautological statement. The problem is you can't set a number at which this is safe and this isn't, and then you have to even define what is safe. So what if, because of your sugar consumption today and it's relatively modest, 30 years from now you end up with heart disease or diabetes that you would not have had if you hadn't eaten that sugar? Then by definition, what we learned 30 years from now is what you were eating today was too much, but we didn't know it now. So the quick issue, like when we talk about cigarettes, the same logic applies, but we never say too much cigarettes cause lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
cigarettes.
We say cigarettes cause it.
Let me get another question right on this line. Dallas, Texas. Karen's calling. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You might have just answered my question. I was going to ask you bottom line safe amount in grams of sugar for the average person, non-obese, non-diabetic.
Bottom line, how many grams a day?
Yeah, and again, can't answer that question. It's funny, my last chapter in my book is called How Little is Too Much, and the first sentence is it's impossible to say. Had we never gotten to the point where we have an obesity and diabetes epidemic, there's evidence out there suggesting that if populations keep their sugar consumption at about what ours was in the 1850s or 1860s, which was about 40 pounds per capita per year, which is probably around 40 grams per day, that we all would have been healthy.
And what is it now?
Very complicated question, surprisingly, but it's at least twice that. It's been up to as high as three times that.
And so 80 or 100 plus pounds per capita per year. It's kind of mind-boggling to think of 120 pounds of sugar.
Enormous amounts of sugar compared to what it used to be. So that's the issue. Once we've become obese and diabetic, though, then the issue of a population in which this epidemic is rampant, we're passing it on to our children without even knowing it, then it's virtually impossible to say. So, you know, if I, like I just said, and for a population like that, I wouldn't try to ration it. If I were a doctor, I would be saying, look, sugar is the reason why you became obese and diabetic. Avoid it.
But for someone who's maybe not obese, maybe not diabetic, but there's Karen, she's in Dallas.
Yeah.
And she's trying to figure out what can I enjoy. Maybe she's thinking I enjoy it. It's all around me. What can I responsibly consume? Are you giving a zero answer?
No. I'm saying I can. She has to decide that for herself. What I wanted to do with writing the book is educate people to what the stakes are and what I believe the arguments should be. But think about alcohol, for instance. We don't regulate alcohol. We don't actually say that no alcohol is the healthiest. Mm-hmm. There are actually a large portion of the public health community who thinks that drinking wine in moderation will make you healthier.
But nobody says that about sugar.
But nobody says that. Well, nobody says it'll make it healthier, except the sugar industry. So, you know, we make a decision as adults whether or not we're going to consume alcohol, and in part how much we're going to consume, and in part how we feel afterward. So I, for one, don't drink alcohol anymore because the next day I am depressed. I feel like crying all day long. So I wish I could drink alcohol, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more so that reason than any others. What I'm arguing at the end of the book is if you experiment with giving up sugar, and if you do it for long enough that you get over those initial cravings, you might find that you feel so healthy and that you don't miss it, and it's not worth going back to. And you might not. I gave up coffee for a year just a couple years ago, all caffeine. And at the end of the year, I said, heck with this. I'm going back to my coffee. I miss it. Life wasn't worth living.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of decision we have to make. There isn't a number that can be given for anyone.
Is it as important to make that decision around sugar as we've come to see it is around tobacco?
Obviously I believe it is. But again, I'm still a minority. This is very much a minority position. So,
and that goes back to what you described before as a couple of misconceived notions that people stick with, scientific community sticks with, pretty strong.
Yeah, the two dominant pillars of modern nutrition theory, I'll throw in a third as well. One is this idea that we get fat merely because we take in excess calories. It's based on the state of nutrition science from the 1870s to the 1920s. It's almost incomprehensibly naive, in large part because it avoids all medical and biological advances from 1920 onward, which include the whole field of endocrinology, which mm-hmm. is the study of hormones, because of this idea that obesity is just an energy balance disorder, it's taking in more calories. The only way foods can make you fat is if they have excess calories, getting into tautology land here, and therefore a calorie is a calorie.
Hold the thought. We've got more points to come to there. That's an interesting one already, and I want to ask you about it. Karen in Dallas, Texas, thank you for calling. Gary Taubes is with us. His new book is The Case Against Sugar. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about a new attack on sugar in our diet as more harmful than we know, a kind of sweet and silent killer. My guest is Gary Taubes. He's gone very deep on sugar, the history, the science, how it may affect us in all kinds of ways. Obesity, type 2 diabetes, he says, yes. But also he's looking at elevated risk for heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's. You can join us this hour. Does it feel addictive to you? What if it's killing us? Have you got sugar out of your diet and seen a difference, felt a difference? What's the best maximum? Well, hard to say. But the FDA did come out last year with some new dietary guidelines recommending limits on sugar. Here was CNN's Sanjay Gupta.
The government is finally putting a limit on sugar, saying it should make up no more than 10% of your daily calories. So if you're on a 2,000-calorie-a-day diet, that's about 50 grams of sugar. Drink more than one regular can of soda, and you've already maxed out.
Boom, you're there. People trying to get Americans to pull back a little bit. This was the Alaska Department of Health last year with a public service announcement about how sugar consumption adds up through the day, especially with sugar-filled drinks.
It's just one soda with dinner. What's the harm? It starts with 11 teaspoons of added sugar in his breakfast drink, 8 teaspoons at lunch, another 9 on the field, and 10 teaspoons for dinner. All these sugary drinks add up to weight gain, diabetes, and tooth decay. For the best help, serve your family water or low-fat milk.
Water, low-fat milk. Gary Taubes is author of The Case Against Sugar. He's with me in the studio. We've got callers to go to, and I want to do that, Gary. But lots of questions online as well. Here, Cover says on Twitter, but why does it taste so good?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things it does is stimulate the area of our brain known as the reward center, technically the nucleus accumbens, that other drugs of abuse do, and other pleasurable. The idea is this part of our brain evolved to reward behaviors that would help procreate the species, so that in eating and sex, in effect.
Yeah, so why does sugar sneak into that?
Well, the argument is all drugs of abuse basically happen to be chemicals that, by chance, stimulate this area of the brain and stimulate the secretion of the dopamine that is what mediates this pleasurable experience. So we go through these, you know, over the course of human history, humans sample tens of thousands of various substances, and the ones that do this are the ones that evolve into our abusive, you know, our drugs of abuse, and sugar is one of them. On the other hand, as a colleague of mine always points out, when you buy a pair of shoes, that also stimulates the same part of the brain. And while some of us are addicted to that, and maybe many of us, and I would bet at this point that iPads in children do too, but I have no data to back that up.
Watch this space. Yeah. Here's another. Kevin says to us, if a food has carbs, it's going to have sugar in it. Kevin asserts here, the problem is refined sugar and high fructose corn syrup. He says, these two products, this is on Twitter, are the worst types of sugars. There are plenty of natural, healthy sweeteners available. True or false, Gary?
Partially true. There are These are the FDA divides the world into, or the USDA, caloric sweeteners and non-caloric sweeteners. So caloric sweeteners are those with calories attached, and the calories come from some combination of glucose and fructose, and that's what we're talking about here. The non-caloric sweeteners are everything from cyclamates, which the FDA banned in 1970-71, to the latest, you know, the world is, I probably know, four or five different startups or industrial concerns, maybe even a dozen, that are trying to come up with new artificial sweeteners. We really don't know about the artificial sweeteners.
This is natural sweeteners, Kevin's asserting.
Natural sweeteners. So they're sweet. Again, dose makes a poison issue. So, for instance, honey is also glucose and fructose. It's similar chemical components. We've never really consumed more than a pound and a half per capita for going back 100 years, probably because, A, it's got the distinctive flavors attached.
Wear out on that flavor.
Yeah, the last time I talked about this, somebody said, you can put it in coffee. And somebody said, no, I do.
Yeah, okay.
it clearly doesn't work in cold drinks because of its viscosity. Mm-hmm. So there's just, I believe if you could consume 100 or 50 pounds per capita of honey a year, it would do the same damage, or almost the same damage, that the sucrose and high fructose corn syrup does.
Let's go to Guthrie, Oklahoma. Patrick is calling. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wondered if you guys could talk about, like, the addictive qualities of sugar. I know myself, I recently lost like 80 pounds just by cutting out refined sugars. And I know that when I get back onto eating some sugar, it just becomes a real habit. And I have to, like, really get myself back into a mindset and fight it to quit. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.
Yeah, and again, there's no really good research. There's some animal research from France that's fascinating, where this French researcher addicted his rats to boluses, daily boluses of cocaine or heroin, and then he offers them sugar water, and they have to make the decision that if they go for the sugar water, they never see the cocaine or the heroin again.
Oh, my gosh.
And they switch over to the sugar in like 2 days.
Wow.
So, from those, we know that at least French laboratory rats find sugar far more addictive than cocaine and about as addictive as, but we don't know how that translates to humans. Clearly, a lot of people have the same response you do.
That is incredible.
So, again, rely on anecdotal information. My wife is capable of ordering a dessert after dinner, having two bites, and pushing it aside, never thinking it again. Yeah. And as soon as she does this, I'm sitting at the restaurant next to her. I've virtuously
spoon across the table.
I'm having this long and deep intellectual conflict about
I should not.
Sugar.
I must not.
Exactly. I will. That's I will. It.
Right. Boom. Done. You know? John in Cleveland, Ohio. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. It's wonderful that a show like this is on the air as far as, talking about these things, because there's just not enough conversation about it in this country.
We're right here for you, John. What's your experience?
So about 2 years ago, cut out all sugars, all processed sugars, pops, sodas, drinks, fruit juices, everything. And the biggest thing that I had noticed was just a big transformation in myself as far as the way I felt. And not to say, dropped 30, 40 pounds roughly and it felt great about all that. It clearly was tied to just things that plague you when you have too much of it, I mean, I do cheat every once in a while and have a few things, and I can actually feel the results of it when I do.
Like what? What's the plague that you feel, John, when you do have sugar?
Well, if I had, like, a little bit too much sugar during the holidays, my feet will start to get numb, my extremities, my hands, an itching on my skin that you'll get with some form of like arthritis, I guess. So it just seems like it's inflammatory in some ways. And then, of course, circulation as well. So the earlier caller that called in, which I thought was interesting, when you flipped over a box and looked at the nutrition label, there's never been a percentage on how much sugar is allowed. Now there's finally, and it took, 30, 40 years since the government talked about this in the 70s, to come up with what is too much. But I don't even think we still are working on percentages, are we?
Yeah, well, clearly, if the USDA guidelines putting the cap at 10% of calories means that they will, if they take the next step, they'll put a percentage on. But again, you have no idea if that's right for you or not. It's a complication. One of the interesting things I'll point out about these issues that clarified when you get sugar is kind of funny. A lot of my research and my two books previously were targeting this whole idea that all refined carbohydrates and sugars are the problem in modern diets, and that led into the common use of low-carbohydrate, high-fat diets to resolve these problems. And so the most famous one is Atkins. And these doctors often looked like quacks because they would say, I put people on these diets and everything gets better. Mm. You know, their psoriasis goes away. Their arthritis clears up. They lose weight. And when doctors talk like this, again, you sound like a quack. There's no way to avoid it. But then one of the problems with writing a book like mine, when I'm linking sugar to all these chronic diseases, I look like a quack because I'm saying there's a simple cause. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to do is bring the science back into it and saying, you know, traditionally when you have epidemics, there are simple causes. They're not themed, hundreds. It's not like, you know, we're trying to explain why World War I started, mm-hmm. where there's 15 different things that came together. We're trying to explain why obesity and diabetes exploded worldwide in every population that eats these diets. Let's start with the simplest hypothesis and only complicate them as necessary. So mm-hmm. the simplest hypothesis is sugar.
John in Cleveland, it sounds like a good idea for you to stick with that, and we wish you luck with it. Simple cause. Are you saying there's a single cause that goes back to all these, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's?
I'm saying there's a don. We know that there's a lifestyle. There's some factor involving the Western diet and lifestyle that triggers these diseases. Because they're all linked to obesity and diabetes, and because the risk increases with obesity and diabetes, the conventional wisdom is kind of schizophrenic on this point. So on one hand, the research community will talk about obesity and diabetes being complex, multifactorial diseases, and there are just too many. And to me, that's an explanation for why they've completely failed to rein in these epidemics. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, they'll say diabetes is caused by excess fat accumulation, and excess fat accumulation is caused by consuming more calories than mm-hmm. you expend. Mm-hmm. So the conventional wisdom is that there is a simple cause, mm-hmm. and I'm saying it's the wrong simple cause.
We've got a listener here, Zach, who says this is misinformation. He says, you can lose weight while eating sugar. I do. You just need to count calories and maintain a deficit over an extended period of time.
Yeah, and again, this is part of this logic that if, you know, we get fat because we consume too many calories, and therefore you're going to get thin if you are in what, you know, we could call negative energy balance. If you're expending more calories than you consume, a simple way to think about how this how naive this is if our caller had, our Twitter mm-hmm. friend had written in and said, look, and we're having a show about wealth. So mm-hmm. instead of talking about the epidemic of obesity and diabetes, we're talking about the epidemic of, you know, obscene wealth in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And I'm saying it's caused by all these various issues. And the caller calls in and says, no, these people got wealthy because they made more money than they spent. And if we want them to be more like us, we have mm-hmm. to get them to spend more money than mm-hmm. they make.
Yeah, okay,
and
that's
it's just and I talk about this deeply in a history called The Gift That Keeps on Giving, because it's this kind of thinking that has led to this the sugar industry getting a free pass for 50 years up until the Second World War, when far and away the best medical science was done in Europe. The European clinical investigators had concluded that obesity was clearly a hormonal regulatory defect, mm-hmm. that this idea that it's a calories in, calories out problem was naive. And then this thinking evaporates with the Second World War. You can actually see it happen in the
literature.
Because
Europe gets blown to bits?
Europe gets blown to bits. We want nothing to do with the European academicians who are fleeing out of Europe. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are Jews. I've been told, although I haven't confirmed it, that universities like Harvard had policies in place in the 40s so that they wouldn't be overrun
snapping them
by
up.
These mm-hmm. academicians. Mm-hmm. And post-World War II, the science of obesity is kind of recreated here at the Harvard School of Public Health, and it's done by young doctors and nutritionists who really have an exceedingly poor understanding of what science is and how to do it, and they think it's easy. It's obvious. Fat people eat too much. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much it for the next – that's where we are 60 years later. Obese people eat too much. We get them to eat less. So you could have – I'm no researchers who – are capable of looking at someone who weighs 400 pounds and thinking that person is carrying 300 pounds of excess fat because they eat too much.
So what's the mechanism that you're describing, or hormonal, the alternative view?
Well, so the alternative view, beginning in 1960, we had the technology available to understand, to actually measure accurately levels of hormone in the bloodstream. And by mid-1960s, it was clear that the fat accumulation in your fat cells is dominated by the hormone insulin, which is the same hormone that's out of whack in diabetes, right? Mm-hmm. So you secrete a lot of insulin, you store calories as fat in your fat cells.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're arguing that sugar is a cause of insulin resistance. If you're resistant to your own insulin, you have to secrete more to do the same job. So mm-hmm. insulin-resistant individuals tend to have high blood sugar, and they tend to have high circulating insulin levels. And under those conditions, their fat cells will accumulate fat. They won't mobilize them for fuel. So by the 1960s, there was a very clear hormonal pathway that should, I'm arguing should have been the null hypothesis, as scientists would call it, that obesity is a hormonal defect, that the dietary trigger is sugar and then highly refined grains that are mm-hmm. triggering insulin secretion, that's triggering fat storage. But by the 1960s, this community thought of obesity as an eating disorder. Actually, the field was dominated by psychologists and psychiatrists mm-hmm. who were mm-hmm. trying to get, you know, obese people, think of tricks, behavioral tricks to mm-hmm. get fat people to eat less.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then by the implication of this biological view of obesity rather than a physics view was that carbohydrates were the problem and mm-hmm. that the way to cure it were by diets the likes of which Robert Atkins was proposing. Mm-hmm. So my work was originally seen as an apologia for Atkins.
Mm-hmm.
Once we decided saturated fat caused heart disease, you couldn't have doctors running around the country selling crazily successful diet books advocating we all eat lobster mm-hmm. Newburgh mm-hmm. and
right.
cheeseburgers without
mm-hmm.
the bun.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical community in the 70s pretty much put the brakes on that, and that's been quackery ever since. And then I came along as an investigative science journalist in the late 90s, no preconception, saying let's actually look at the science, and the science supports this viewpoint that obesity is a hormonal regulatory defect, that it's triggered by the carbs and particularly sugar, and that the way to reverse it, the healthiest way to reverse it, is with a diet the likes of which Atkins was pushing 50 years ago and other people were pushing 100 years before him.
Heavy on protein.
Heavy on protein, heavy on fat, which nobody, you know, was one of the reasons these diets morphed into high protein diets. And one of the most successful in the 90s was Protein Power, a terrific book, but it became politically unacceptable to talk about these diets as high fat diets. So instead, we mm-hmm. talked about them as high protein.
Mm-hmm.
Even when, you know, you watch a cooking show and the Top Chef, which I used to be addicted to.
Mm-hmm.
And the chefs will talk about the protein portion of the plate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a primary, that protein portion typically has more fat per calories than it does protein calories. We just don't mention that.
Nobody wants to say fat. In Gary Taub's world, we would maybe say sugar a lot less or eat a lot less of it. Think about it. He says, like tobacco. This is really deep and fascinating. It gets all the way into our endocrinology, our hormone system, and all the rest, and it's been absolutely fascinating talking with you about it. Gary Taub's new book is The Case Against Sugar. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Gary Taub, thank you so much for being here today. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining with all your stories here and online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.